This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Arroway. And today is a pretty gloomy, drizzly day in Brooklyn. It's actually marathon day here in New York City. So, other than running in the marathon, it's a great day for cooking. And I'm really excited to be sharing a cookbook that I adore today. It just came out this fall from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I've often told friends that I, like, one of the dreams that I have is to collect a different cookbook for every single country in the world. That is a cookbook that is solely devoted to that one country's cuisine and its people and its culture. And so I'm really excited to have a cookbook that delves into the unique cuisine of Turkey. It is called Istanbul and Beyond, and its author, Robin Eckhart, is on the line right now. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Kathy.
Thanks so much for joining.
Thanks for having me on the show.
A wonderful cookbook. Not only is it covering a cuisine that I'm less familiar with, but it does so in such a fabulous, in-depth, and visually stunning, and rich with insights, and of course, fabulous-looking recipes along the way.
Good to hear.
Yeah, and I understand it's the product of some 20 years of researching and traveling in the country.
Yes, we first went to Turkey in 1998, the photographer David Hagerman and I, and fell in love with Turkey, and that prompted me to study Turkish, and we sort of went back when we could, and then at that time when we visited Turkey, neither of us were doing what we do now. Dave was in business, and I was working on a PhD. Fast forward 12 years, we were both freelancers, he in photography and I as a food and travel writer. And so we revisited Turkey after an absence of 8 years and felt this inexplicable pull that we'd felt when we first visited in 1998. And so at that time kind of decided to, you know, that we had the time and we had the freedom to do something in Turkey to make it a bigger part of our lives. And the idea for the book came about a year later.
Yeah, I'm curious, though, about how, since this is such a long lead project and then you've seen it transform throughout the past couple decades, I'm curious about that. But first of all, if you could just sort of orient us with the region that we're talking about, Turkey, it's, you know, where and who are the Turkish people?
Okay, so the book focuses on the foods of Istanbul. And then after the opening chapter in which we are in Istanbul, and it's my Istanbul, really, it's the foods that I'm most interested in when I'm there, we jump across the western half of the country to the east. Mm-hmm. I was interested to focus on a part of Turkey that most foreigners don't travel to, and even a lot of Turks don't travel to. People who live in Western Turkey, parts of the country who with interesting and little lesser known cuisines, and also a lot of Kurdish food that I wanted to shine a spotlight on. And it should be said that Turkey has 7 official regions.
Okay.
The regions, as in the book, are as I defined them by traveling the country by road and observing changes in topography and climate and how that translated to what people eat. So the regions quickly are the Black Sea, coast up in the north, and it's you can imagine it to be a little bit like the Pacific Northwest in terms of climate.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It's very lush and green, and
Wines. It's
rainy, and it doesn't get a lot of snow except at higher elevations, and the diet is lots of leafy greens, lots of fish, no surprise there, and lots of corn, which is very unusual.
That is really unusual, Robin.
Dried corn in all shapes and forms and ways. And then we just sort of went in a clockwise, as if we were doing a road trip, because this was the result of road trips. So we moved towards the Georgian border, and we're in northeastern Turkey, an area of lush, high plateaus, perfect for grazing cows, and this is a part of the country in which one's wealth is measured in how many cows one has, and so you don't find lamb here really that much. There's a lot of beef, and there's tons of dairy, and then we moved south to Van and Hakkari, which are Kurdish provinces bordering Iran and Iraq. The landscape changes dramatically. It's very craggy, a very rough topography, craggy, rough foothills, not much arable land. And so there's a lot of sheep, not sheep really, mutton in the diet, because it's only sheep and goats that can sort of handle this kind of rough terrain. You couldn't really graze cows there. And as a result of the lack of arable land, most of which is devoted to raising feed crops, people forage in the spring, and that is where a lot of the greens in the diet come from, is just these wild herbs and vegetables that people forage literally by the tons in the spring, and then add to a local cheese called herbed cheese that is made from the milk that comes from the sheep and goats that, you know, pasture on the same herbs. So it's a really tight little circle there. And then we moved back west to the southeast, Shanli Urfa province, people may know because of Urfa pepper. That is the home of Urfa pepper, and Diyarbakir, which is a Kurdish province. And here you see the appearance of like lots of spices, lots of heat, more chilies, more lamb. Lamb kind of reappears in the diet.
Okay.
And then we continue to go west and dip down to Hatay province, which is a Mediterranean province bordered by the Mediterranean on one side and Syria on the other. It used to be part of Syria until the early 20th century. And so here's a very Levantine-influenced cuisine.
Okay.
It's if we think of, you know, Middle Eastern food or Levantine food, this is what we're imagining. Olive oil, pomegranates, pomegranate molasses, chilies, heat, fresh herbs, very lively, very vibrant. And then the last region was, we just drove kind of straight north from Hatay into north central Anatolia. And this is really the cuisine that, you know, when people think of what is Turkish food, this is what people kind of often imagine. Lots of lamb, lots of grains, lots of legumes, and a bit of dairy.
Wow. So Turkey is like so many cuisines in itself. And, you know, it's a very horizontal land too. And Istanbul is all the way on the west.
Right.
But yet there's this huge, you know, region, and it borders something like 10 different other countries.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and there are definitely influences from, I mean, especially when you get far east, you can see Persian influences, and you can see Georgian influences. And, you know, I mean, national borders are basically artificial. So you can see this, you know, as you approach a border, we're looking at influences from other countries.
Right, right. And it's a fascinating history behind, you know, each of these areas. Let's start with Istanbul, because that's where you start off your journey.
Right.
Because you write that it's home to one of, like, this one city itself is home to one of the world's great fusion cuisines, because of all the different peoples. Can you give us a little sort of, I guess, snapshot of who makes up current Istanbul? Not Constantinople. Just kidding.
So Istanbul, as probably your listeners know, was the capital of the Ottoman Empire, a great port city. It still is a port city. And so you had influences, you had foods imported from across the empire, while the rest of Turkey under the Ottoman Empire pretty much ate the way it always had eaten. People in Istanbul had access to rice from Persia. They had, you know, coffee came from Africa. Kofte came from the Balkans, also like dairy products like kaymak, the rich sort of clotted cream that you find in Istanbul, came from the Balkans. And it also had the Topkapı Palace, where there were literally thousands of cooks, you know, working to make ever more complicated and outrageous dishes to impress the emperor.
Cool.
And that's what we call palace cuisine. That's not really it's not really what people eat every day. Dishes like a mackerel, where you take out the flesh and you chop it and you mix it with all these warm spices and raisins and pine nuts, and then you stuff it back into the fish so it's still whole.
What?
And I mean, they are just some cooks not going to do that. But those sort of complicated, richly spiced dishes are what you can associate with sort of higher cuisine in Istanbul.
You also
and then
mentioned,
Istanbul
though,
is really also a place of street food because yeah. it is a city, it's a very busy city, and people need something to eat quickly, you know,
right.
on the go.
A lot of street
and,
food.
And it is really where these restaurants called Esnaf Lokanta, which means basically tradesmen's canteens, started in the late mid to late 1800s when offices started opening up on the European side. And people wanted to eat lunch, you know, but they couldn't go all the way home for lunch. So these lovely homey places opened up, and they're still there, where you've got a steam table, and it's got all these soups and stews and very home-style, basically home-style dishes mm-hmm. That are reasonably priced and that could service office workers. And I just want to say that a lot of visitors go to Istanbul and they poke their heads in these places and they see the steam tables and they go, no, because they're thinking American visitors, especially I think buffets. But no, these are dishes that, you know, you want cooked low and slow over low heat. This is the closest you can get to home cooking without going into a home.
That's funny. I love that you write that also halva, that sesame sort of sesame seed or tahini dessert, is one of the sort of relics of palace cuisine. Because the pantries, why was that? It held up well in the pantries of palaces?
Oh, well, it's made with a technique that the average, you know, cook in Istanbul wouldn't have invented
right.
on their own.
A little complicated.
Whenever it was invented. It uses I'm forgetting the name of the mugwort.
Okay.
It's a type of root that is ground and added to the sesame to create that kind of fluffy honeycomb texture.
Right.
I mean, it's not something that's super easy to make at home. And,
right.
you know, these people in the palace had access to all the ingredients. For instance, white sugar. I mean, cane sugar or beet sugar was not used in Turkey before the Ottoman Empire, and it was able to be imported. People used fruit molasses to sweeten things. And it was, you know, the palace cooks who first had access to this exotic, like, for lack of a better word, ingredient, because it was rare and it was expensive. So you've got all these sweets with, you know, syrupy sweets and things like halva that incorporate a rare and, you know, expensive ingredient that you know, only an emperor could afford, basically.
Right. Well, I love that you explore the cuisines. It's in the subtitle, you know, exploring the diverse cuisines, plural, of Turkey. It really opens your eyes to how much you don't know about its cuisine. Why is it, though, that you mentioned earlier that the foods that we tend to think of when we think of Turkish food is that lamb-based northern cuisine? How did that become the more popular, well-known type of foods from Turkey in America?
Well, I think it's a function of what Turkish restaurants in America serve. There are a lot of Turkish restaurants here. I've been trying to explore them as I move around the country. And with really a very few exceptions, one being Oleana in Boston, they tend to have a menu that is just, you know, very set.
Yeah.
You've got kebabs, maybe a doner, a few meze or small plates that are recognizable, like hummus, baba ganoush, maybe esme, which is a finely ground tomatoes and chili pepper. They might serve some bread. It's a very, you know, that if you don't know Turkey and you haven't been to Turkey and you haven't eaten fairly widely in Turkey, you're going to know Turkish food from what you find at a Turkish restaurant in America,
yeah.
And those menus tend to be fairly limited.
Huh, yeah. It is interesting how a sort of like American cuisine version of different cuisines sort of just cements itself once it's here.
Right.
Yeah, okay, so I have to be a little corny, Robin, since
sure.
we have Thanksgiving coming up. What dishes do you think from Turkey would pair especially well with turkey?
There's a dish from North Central Anatolia in that chapter mm-hmm. of cracked wheat and pumpkin or butternut squash.
That
it's super
awesome.
Simple. You basically put, you know, you saute some onions and you put cracked wheat or pearled farro or pre-soaked wheat berries in a pan, and you add some cubed pumpkin and you add water and you cook it till it's all soft and it becomes a sort of risotto texture. And I mean, pumpkin is perfect for this time of year.
Yeah. It sounds like you could maybe even use that for stuffing.
I think a hazelnut dessert called hazelnut kadayıf cake. It's in the Black Sea chapter. And to me, there is something about it that is reminiscent of pecan pie.
Okay.
In the way the sugar caramelizes a little bit and the nuts are in there. I think it'd be great dessert. And I think that you can never, you know, go wrong by starting a Thanksgiving dinner with a few, tasty appetizers or just kind of small bites to get the palate going. Mm-hmm. There's a recipe from Hot Thai that I particularly like. It's a salad of sun-dried tomato and pomegranate seeds and parsley and pomegranate molasses and olive oil with the little chilies and just a couple of spoonfuls of that I could totally see on a Thanksgiving table before the main course.
Those sound like wonderful options. And I'm sure there are many more. I love that you're just like, yep, here we go. Butternut squash.
I keep talking. I'll stop now.
No. actually, we're going to cut to, we're going to talk a lot more about some of the amazing looking recipes in this book after a quick little commercial break, and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
All right, we're back chatting more with the author of Istanbul and Beyond. It's Robin Eckhart. Hi, you still with us?
Hi.
All right, Kathy. Great. So, you know, going through this cookbook, there's a lot of dishes that look somewhat familiar. There's dolmas or stuffed vegetables. There's stuffed cabbage, which I love. And I come across a dish that looks a little bit like shakshuka, that Israeli eggs poached in tomato sauce.
I think a Turk would say that shakshuka is a little bit like menemen.
Okay, so this is menemen. Right, so let's talk about some of the differences. By the way, this looks beautiful. It's chunky tomato and pepper sauce with poached eggs, and it's called menemen. Is that right?
Right.
Okay. So
it's a common breakfast dish. Mm-hmm. You know, Turks love breakfast. Most people know that people in Turkey, across Turkey, love breakfast, although there is no such thing as a Turkish breakfast. They're all differ depending on where you are. Yeah, that's basically, you know, you just saute some onions, peppers, and tomatoes, and you break eggs in it and poach the eggs. And then there's another version which had to be cut from the book for lack of space, which is you make the sauce, then you puree it. Then you beat the eggs into the sauce and you put it back in a pan. So you kind of get this sort of almost a souffled kind of menemen thing.
Cool.
And yeah, I think the interesting thing with the book is that there are dishes that will kind of sound familiar, but they they're done in a different way, or they incorporate some slightly different ingredients, or there are dishes that incorporate ingredients that everyone knows, but they're just done in a different way to create a different flavor. So you mentioned the cabbage rolls. That's a recipe from Diyarbakir, which is a mostly Kurdish province. The filling is beef or lamb with rice, seasoned with chili pepper and a lot of dried mint. And then it's rolled into cabbage leaves, pretty standard procedure. But the sauce that it's cooked in is a combination of tomato and water, soured liquid made by soaking sumac, dried sumac in water, and then draining off the sumac. And sumac and sour flavors are really kind of a hallmark of Kurdish cuisine in Turkey. And so you've got these cabbage rolls that kind of look like something you know, but they taste quite different because of the vibrant spices both in the filling and then this sort of soured tomato sauce that's coating it.
It looks delicious. And I love all those other surprising combinations. I mean, really, every dish is just, it's a, it's a novelty for me, at least.
It is widely used, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, like the pumpkin, I mean, sorry, the meatballs with pumpkin and spice butter. It's a look just like a wonderful, like warming winter dish.
Yeah, that's a, that's proven to be a really popular dish. And I have to say it's one of my favorites and also one of David, the photographer's favorites. It incorporates, it's, you know, it's very simple. I try to mimic the texture of meatballs or kofte in Turkey. They're never hard and heavy. Like, they're never heavy like American meatballs. There's no bread, there's no eggs, there's no milk. And I chop the ingredients into the meat instead of using my hands to knead it or putting in the food processor, which creates a lighter meatball. And then it's just a very simple sauce of tomato paste dissolved in water. This is very common across Turkey. Tomato paste is used in this sauce basey way. And then the sort of surprise at the end is a butter in which you've sizzled chilies, dried chili, and purple basil, which I never associated with Turkish food before I started exploring in the East. It's really common. It holds its scent better than basil, Italian basil does when it's dried. And I know it is available online, but if you can't get it, you can substitute Italian basil mixed with ground anise, and it just mimics the flavor, and you just sizzle it in butter and pour it over the top. It's really good. I mean, really a fall dish.
And I love that it has, like, pumpkin. You say pumpkin or any winter squash, like acorns, kabocha, or butternut. Chunks that we can use, which, you know, might be great for leftovers.
Oh, yeah. And it's nice because it cooks and then the little corners of the whatever you're using, squash or pumpkin, kind of dissolve into
use
the sauce and thicken it. It's a good one.
Wonderful. I come across a dish that really, I'm like, what? No, it's called cornmeal pie with leeks and greens. It sounds like something I would see in like an American Southern cookbook. But you mentioned that they eat corn and grow corn in this region.
Right.
So.
Yeah, if you travel along the Black Sea in autumn, you will see garlands of corn cobs hanging from the characteristic timber houses and, you know, on lawns and hung from balconies. Corn is a staple of the diet on the Black Sea. And if you go quite far south, you know, they'll say, oh, those Black Sea people, they eat corn, those corn eaters, because down south, corn is animal feed.
Is that derogatory?
So this is really just a Black Sea thing. Corn is, after the cobs are dried, the kernels are stripped and they're used whole in soups and stews. They're cracked for pilavs. They're ground into cornmeal, and so fish is dipped in cornmeal and fried. And then they're ground into flour for breads and things like this cornmeal pie, which is really kind of like a, for me, it kind of encapsulates Black Sea cuisine in that it uses corn, and then it's just filled with all these wonderful grains, charred, collard, and very textured, thick, sturdy spinach are found on the Black Sea. And then in the winter, you have leeks that grow literally as high as your hip. And those are also major ingredients. So this dish is also proving to be a favorite, and it's proving to be really surprising to people. It's delicious.
Yeah.
It's nothing that I would have associated with Turkey before I went to the Black Sea.
But it looks so like so many of these dishes, so universally sort of pleasing.
Yeah, I think they're very accessible because because they're surprising. They're just, you know, they are Turkish, but they're not what you'd expect.
Right. So corn is from the New World. So at some point they must have, you know, it caught on in the Black Sea region. Another thing that is from the New World is turkeys, but I didn't see any mention of turkey in this book.
Sorry, I didn't get that.
Turkeys.
Turkeys.
Yes, the birds.
Yeah, they raise turkeys in Turkey.
They do. I didn't see any recipes for them.
I've seen people will keep turkeys. I don't think it's a sort of like in Italy, you can buy turkey at the grocery store. It's everywhere, at least in northern Italy where I live. But it's not, it's more of a backyard, like if you're keeping chickens, you have a few mm-hmm. turkeys. Mm-hmm. And I did ask how turkey is prepared, and it would generally be, it's a New Year's Eve thing in Istanbul to stuff a turkey with seasoned rice and roast it. Mm-hmm. And then outside of Istanbul, it's sort of prepared like you would boil the turkey to create a broth, and then you would cook rice in the broth, and then you would serve the two together.
Huh. So can you tell us why we call this bird turkeys?
You're breaking up.
Oh, sorry. Do you know the reason why we called turkeys turkeys?
No, I have to admit that I don't, but okay. I sort of remember reading something about that online.
Do you know? Yeah, I think roughly at the point that it was being traded into Britain, it was coming from Turkey or via Turkey from obviously the New World where they're from.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know the whole ins and outs of that, but it's just kind of odd, the whole thing. And the fact that there's no turkey recipe in this book, although the examples that you did mention sound amazing. But, you know, as a port city, I'm seeing so many interesting ingredients used throughout this book. Istanbul, that is, thanks to that geographic sort of opportunity. And it's just interesting to see corn taking on. What is your favorite, Robin? What is your favorite recipe?
My favorite recipe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I hate that question. That is really, really hard. I could tell you my favorite recipe from each chapter. Love the meat. I really do love the meatball and pumpkin thing from the Vaughn and Hakari chapter. I really love the lamb and chickpea stew from the Northeast chapter.
That looks
delicious
great.
And easy. I love all fish. I especially love the baked salmon or bluefish with lots of herbs from the Black Sea chapter. I love every appetizer from the Hatay chapter because it's a really a mezze place, but especially the bakla, which is pureed dried fava beans with tahini and garlic and cumin. Mm. From the Southeast, there's a recipe for meatballs that are cooked in concentric circles with seared pieces of eggplant on a bed of very thymy tomato sauce, and I love that. I love the orange cookies from the Istanbul chapter, and I also love the grilled fish sandwich from the Istanbul chapter.
Oh, you just got me so hungry right now. all right, well, we're about out of time, but I just wanted to see, you know, I just wanted to sort of kind of ask you, what do you hope for readers to take away? What is like the most interesting thing that you think?
I hope for readers to both have their idea of Turkish food expanded. Mm-hmm. I hope for readers to be taken to parts of Turkey that maybe they haven't thought about before. And I hope, well, obviously, as any cookbook author, I hope people will be inspired to get into the kitchen, but I also hope that they will be inspired to visit Turkey if they haven't already. And people often ask me, can I go to Turkey now? Is it safe? And I would say, if you'd go to Paris or Brussels or Barcelona, you should go to Turkey.
Right.
It's an amazing place.
You're right. Not everyone thinks of this as a great food destination, but I would hope that...
Oh, it's a fabulous food destination.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for sharing that throughout this book. And brava on capturing all these amazing recipes throughout all the regions. So,
thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin. And
thanks for having me on the show.
Wonderful. Thank you. And thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.